I think what we're witnessing in Gabon is a continued manifestation of a process of decolonialization in Africa, especially in regards to France. You know, France had extensive colonial interests in Africa. And even when, in the aftermath of the Second World War, France shed its colonies, it didn't really shed the colonies, it just redefined them in a post-colonial reality that that many call neo-colonialism. It's basically, in France, they called it France-Afrique, pardon my French if I didn't say that correct, but the notion was that France would continue to dominate its former colonial territories in Africa by controlling the political, economic, social, and military aspects of that country, up to and including controlling the currency that the countries use. In the case of Gabon, it has been a strategic part of France's overall strategic posture since gaining its independence. Gabon was a source of uranium that made the French independent nuclear force possible. It allowed France to develop a nuclear capability independent of the United States. And interestingly enough, especially given France's current posture vis-a-vis Niger, where France has rejected a military coup that ousted a pro-French president, the current or recently ousted president of Gabon is the son of a man who was put in power in Gabon in a military coup that was backed by the French army, because France has played that sort of role, controlling the destiny of these post-colonial assets. And I think Africa is waking up. They're realizing that the continued poverty that grips these nations, whether it be Mali, Burkina Faso, Guinea, Niger, Gabon, others, these are all nations that that are adrift in domestic chaos and poverty, while a political and economic elite thrive. The military, which, while the officers may be an elite, the rank and file are drawn from the people, and therefore the military in some ways is more representative of the genuine will of the people, is tired of sustaining this. And this is why we see successive military coups occurring to oust pro-French political elites. And Gabon is the most recent example of this. This is something that is a existential threat to France. France has extensive economic ties to Africa, and the rapid disintegration of these ties will reverberate into the French economy, and that will have political reverberations, because many of the French political elite have gained their wealth because of the continued exploitation of Africa. So there will be consequences. France cannot be expected just to go quietly into that night, but France is not a superpower. While France has limited military capacity in Gabon, it's not sustainable military capacity, meaning that if Gabon, the junta in Gabon decided to forcefully evict France, there's literally nothing France could do unless the United States was willing to come to its assistance. And I don't see the United States lining up to support the post-colonial policies of France in Africa. We see this in Niger, where France has taken a very militant stance against the military junta there, refusing, for example, to withdraw an ambassador, despite the fact that the junta said the ambassador must leave. The United States has not weighed in on this, nor has the United States weighed in on the potential of military intervention by pro-French African forces that are being constituted as we speak under the umbrella of ECOWAS, the Economic Cooperation of West African States. I think the future is dire for France. They are going to come face to face with the limits of their power and the rage of Africa, which has had it up to here with French post-colonial policies.
Wir haben es ja bereits angesprochen, erst Mali, Burkina Faso, dann Niger und nun Gabun. Warum erleben wir derzeit eine Reihe von Militärputschen in Afrika? Siehst du einen Zusammenhang etwa mit dem Ukraine-Krieg oder dem Aufstieg der BRICS?
I mean, on the surface, the causal effects of these coups, the breakup of France, Franc-Afrique, is derived from the history of France-Afrique, independent of BRICS, independent of Ukraine. It's the consequences of bad policy stretched out over decades. But, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. And so the disintegration of confidence in Africa toward France has been accelerated, I believe, by a global trend towards multipolarity that emphasizes the sovereignty of the nation over a continued adherence to a singularity. The African model of being subordinated to the French singularity is in many ways paralleled by the global model where the United States has insisted on global adherence to the rules-based international order that the United States imposed on the world following the end of the Second World War. And the rejection of these models of singularity by much of the world, parallel. So I do see parallel development of the former French colonies rejecting the French singularity with the rest of the world rejecting the American singularity. And they're linked by the BRICS process. BRICS is a economic forum that emphasizes multipolarity, emphasizes the equality of nations. And I think that we see the maturation of BRICS, which just occurred in South Africa in the recent summit, where BRICS transformed itself from an organization that had potential into an organization that was realizing its potential. The expansion of BRICS and the power that's going to accrue, economic power that's going to accrue collectively, is a transformative moment. I don't think the world has woken up to just how important the South African BRICS summit was. Literally pre-summit, the United States could make a claim that it was and continued to be the world's most influential economic power. Post-BRICS, the United States has been eclipsed by this unified BRICS. It's not just the United States, but the G7 and the entire rules-based international order has been eclipsed by this new multipolarity that's going to dominate the world going forward. So, I just don't think people will. I know in America we haven't woken up to this fact. The fact is, this is a hard thing for Americans to accept. We're no longer number one. We're number two. And what's number one is a Chinese-led BRICS that's acting in concert against the policies of the United States that promote American hegemony over global unity. Well, I think Africa as a continent is on a trajectory towards greatness. The speed to which Africa is able to achieve this greatness, however, is influenced by a lot of factors. For instance, in West Africa, where we see Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, Guinea, breaking free of the chains of French neocolonialism, and Gabon, the same thing. These are poverty-stricken nations that have great potential in terms of normalizing their economies if they're able to gain control of their resources and have them developed in a responsible manner. But you can't do that if you're gripped by war. And there's the real possibility of a regional war in West Africa of military intervention in Gabon as France resists this this transformation that's taking place. And a war will set the region back by decades. And I think, unfortunately, this is France's or Africa's fate going forward, because it never really shook off the chains of European colonialization. Europe continues to steal a line from Rudyard Kipling to bear the white man's burden. It's a very racist approach, a very Eurocentric approach that only Europe can decide the fate of Africa. It's an approach that's been embraced by the United States, which similarly believes that it knows better than Africa about the fate of Africa. And many in Africa have yet to develop the national skill set necessary to become truly sovereign states. So this is going to require more unrest, more disruption, more revolution, perhaps, which in turn will slow down the trajectory of Africa's progression towards a continent of greatness. But the bottom line is, Africa is a continent that has tremendous resources, tremendous human potential, and once that human potential can be realized and those resources can be accessed in a way that benefits the owners of those resources, I think we're going to see Africa surpass Europe as a continent of importance. I actually think that question has been asked and answered, not by us, but by the Pentagon. We have to look back in July when Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State of the United States, traveled to China. It was in many ways a humiliating trip for him because he had to work his way through a succession of junior Chinese officials and be subjected to nonstop criticism of U.S.-China policy before he got a 30-minute meeting with Xi Jinping. And it was a cursory meeting where he wasn't even granted a joint press conference at the end, left alone to explain why he was in China and why he had been treated so badly. Why would the United States allow its Secretary of State to go through this process? It's because the United States realized that the trajectory of its China policy was leading towards the inevitability of a conflict with China that the United States could not win. The Pentagon, in the form of a lieutenant general named Hanaud, had been running war games for years about every possible scenario of potential U.S.-China conflict in the Pacific area. And every time China not only won, but won in a major way. And Hanaud said, there's no way we can defeat China, so therefore we have to ensure that our policies don't inadvertently get us involved in a conflict with China. So the Pentagon knows that it can't win a war against China. At all, zero chance. And I think that just answers what's going to happen with the Philippines, because if the Philippines is told by the United States that we will not be there for you if you start a fight with China, then they won't start a fight with China. Australia isn't going to take the lead in fighting China because, frankly speaking, it doesn't have a military capable of surviving, you know, a day, a week against a conflict with China. I think right now there's a lot of noise being made. This is an issue that predates the General Hanaud revelation that the United States can't win a conflict, but it will be resolved diplomatically. I don't believe the United States will allow this to spin out of control and precipitate a conflict that the United States knows it can't win. You know, there's a the commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger, when he took over a couple of years ago, did a review of the Marine Corps' missions that they were assigned. And those missions are derived from a national defense strategy and the national national security strategy put out by the Pentagon and by the White House. And one of the things that he was tasked with doing as a Marine officer was to ensure that the Marine Corps could confront China in the South Pacific, in Taiwan, et cetera. And when he reviewed Marine Corps capabilities, he said, we can't do this. We have been failing our country, failing our leadership, because we continue to claim we can accomplish something. But when we take a look at the true force structure of the Marine Corps as it's currently organized, compared with the threat that the Marine Corps would have to deal with, the Marine Corps can't do its job. And one of the main reasons why is because the Marine Corps was very married to what he called a legacy thinking, legacy systems. And this dates back to the Second World War, where the Marine Corps put amphibious forces on naval vessels, and then they went to an area and they conducted large-scale amphibious operations. That works if the ships don't sink. But today, when you put a lot of Marines on very few ships and you sail them to a hostile shore where you're going to be subjected to deadly fires from ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, hypersonic missiles that you don't have the ability to defend yourself from, thereby creating the inevitability of ship being sunk with a lot of Marines on it, you can't win that war. And so what General Berger says, we have to rethink the way we fight the Chinese. We have to get away from our legacy attachment to large navies. And that's the reality of the U.S. Navy, of any Navy in the Pacific right now. If you think that you're going to be able to replay the Second World War by sailing ships off a coast, you're wrong. Those ships will be sunk. And that's why the being attacked by a cat, a legacy system here. But that's why the continued affinity for large navies it doesn't square with logic. They're very expensive. Aircraft carriers are hugely expensive things. It's a small city, 5,000 to 7,000 people crammed into this small city. It's an airport with billions of dollars of aircraft taking off. The way the United States views it as the ability to project power around the world. We take carrier battle groups and we project power. We put them off the coast of a country or in a region and thereby send a signal that we are here. We can project our power. But if that ship sinks before it even gets there, all you've done is project weakness. And this is the reality of any future conflict in the Pacific, that where one side relies upon legacy systems and the other side relies upon a new way of thinking. The United States is addicted to legacy systems. We put all of our money into them. The Chinese have focused on the area denial systems, the area protection systems, these ballistic missiles. And that's why we come back to what I talked about earlier, General Hanot and the conclusions reached by the Pentagon, that if we go to war against China, we're going to lose because we don't have the capacity to defeat China, because we have trapped ourselves in a way of thinking that goes back to the Second World War. Well, when we say modern warfare, look, a lot of the conflicts in the world today are low-intensity conflicts, counterinsurgency conflicts that take place and lands far away from American shores, sometimes in areas where America doesn't have access to air bases on the ground. So the ability to take an aircraft carrier and park it off of, park it into the Indian Ocean or the Arabian Sea and launch aircraft that could strike the Taliban in Afghanistan, that's useful. because the Taliban can't strike back. The same thing, if we park an aircraft carrier into the Red Sea or the Persian Gulf and use those planes to strike ISIS or Al-Qaeda, it's useful because ISIS and Al-Qaeda can't strike back. But if we wanted to go to war against, say, Iran, any aircraft carrier operating the Persian Gulf would be sunk. Aircraft carriers operating the Red Sea would be put at risk. You know, an aircraft carrier has aircraft. That's why it's called an aircraft carrier. And what makes it relevant is the ability to launch those airplanes and recover those airplanes. If the aircraft carrier launches the airplanes and then is sunk or damaged, those airplanes can't land. The aircraft carrier has lost its utility. If the aircraft carrier has to continue to maneuver in a way to stay survivable so that it can't launch or recover aircraft, then it's just a very expensive piece of junk. And this is the reality of modern war. The aircraft carrier has an embarked air wing, which is very lethal. It has the ability to project American air power into an area. But not only is the aircraft carrier at risk, but the aircraft themselves are at risk. You know, we haven't fought against an enemy that has an integrated air defense system since the 1991 Gulf War, when we fought against Iraq. The capabilities of peer level forces like China and Russia, especially in the realm of air defense, is such that these aircraft aren't survivable either. I think the aircraft carrier has lost its utility as a weapons system. I think you see, for instance, what's going on in Ukraine and how Russia employs its air power. Russia does, you know, I think the world's become sort of accustomed to what they see on in Hollywood or what they see in computer games where you call in close air support. There's somebody on the ground. He radios in, I'm in trouble. Come save me. And then the American airplanes come in like hawks and they dive down and they strafe the enemy and they roll over and they bomb and the pilot salutes the guys as he flies by and waves his wings. You try that in a real war, you'll get down immediately. Done. Finished. The Russians don't fly over the battlefield. They approach the battlefield. They launch their weapons from a distance and then they get out because if they get too close, they get shot down. That's just the reality of it. And so I think, you know, when we look at modern warfare, we need to rethink how we use aircraft, and then we have to rethink the investment we've made into aircraft carriers. General Berger, the commandant of the Marine Corps, made a decision that the Marine Corps was going to stop relying on legacy systems. It was going to change the way it operated by reorganizing. They got rid of tanks, for instance, so to make themselves more agile. They don't come in with, you know, putting 700 guys on a ship. They now broke it down to where they have 70 guys, 50 guys, small mobile units that can maneuver, come together where needed, disperse, survivability. And I think that might have to be the approach of the United States Navy as well, that the day of the aircraft carrier is finished. But unfortunately, we're probably not going to recognize that until one or more of them have been sunk and thousands of American lives are lost. When Ukraine and NATO collaborated to build the current counterattack force, 12 brigades, Ukraine had said, we need, you know, this many tanks, this many infantry fighting vehicles, this much artillery, this much ammunition. It was done with the design of turning that force into a NATO-style combined arms offensive strike force that would use NATO-style combined arms warfare to defeat the Russian defensive positions. Combined arms warfare is an extraordinarily difficult way to fight. It requires that every aspect of it, combined arms warfare brings together the infantry, the artillery, the armor, the air, the electronic warfare, logistics, engineering, all these individual skill sets not only have to be experts in what they do individually, but then they have to learn to come together and work in concert with one another. There's a tremendous amount of training required to do this. You can't take Ukrainian soldiers who receive 21 days of basic training and then 3 weeks of combined arms training and expect them to replicate the skill set that a NATO-style force has that has, you know, received months and years of training on this. There's artificial expectations on the part of NATO that Ukraine would be able to replicate what they had learned in the classroom on the battlefield. But as General Zelensky has pointed out to his NATO partners and counterparts, you can't speak of doing NATO-style warfare if you don't have NATO-style resources. And the major resource missing from the Ukrainians is air power. They have no air power. They have no ability to sweep the skies free of Russian fighters, to prevent Russian helicopters from flying, to interdict Russian air defense, or to provide close air support to advancing Ukrainian soldiers. And so the Ukrainian counteroffensive was doomed to fail. The United States and NATO have countered by saying, we knew this going in, and we knew that you were going to take casualties. But the important thing is that once you start the fight, you have to press the fight. You have to keep pushing. Ukraine cannot be casualty averse. You know, we train 60,000 troops, 40,000 are dead. I don't know much casualty averse you want the Ukrainians to be. They've shown a willingness to throw their troops into the battle. What Ukraine has said initially is that the massed armored attacks didn't succeed, that what they're doing instead of massed armored attacks was to instead lead with infantry and let the infantry work its way forward through the minefields into the obstacle belts and get closer to the Russians, push the Russians back. And Ukraine has done that with limited success. I mean, they lose an awful lot of people this way as well. But NATO is saying this is too slow. You're not going to get the dramatic results that you need in the time that you need them. You have to go back to these massed armored attacks. So I think what we're seeing right now is Ukraine trying to make one last adjustment. In the course of the past week, we've seen Ukraine launching massive armor attacks, and they have made some gains. They've gained a kilometer here, 2 kilometers there, 5 kilometers here, but the costs are prohibitive. Ukraine has committed its last strategic reserves into this fight. They are being decimated as we speak. And, you know, when those reserves are depleted, Ukraine won't have anything to sustain the fight. And whatever gains they've made will be given back to Russia as Russia counterattacks and then pushes Ukraine back further. This is the reality of the Ukrainian counteroffensive. It's doomed to fail. It was always doomed to fail. And the sad thing is that NATO allowed this to happen because NATO isn't doing this because they believe Ukraine can win. NATO is doing this because they want to inflict harm on Russia. The NATO goal and objective is not to see Ukraine seize Crimea through force of arms, but rather for Ukraine to inflict such harm on Russia that the Russian political will to fight is ends, and Russia will voluntarily withdraw from the territories, including Crimea. It's wishful thinking. It's not going to happen. But, when theory meets reality on the battlefield, the result is always dead people. And there's a lot of dead Ukrainians right now because of this tragic mistake being made by NATO and the Ukrainian government.